The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the show for September 6th, 2012, and it's about ethics. So, Jeff, did you ever look back on a job you just finished and realize you didn't quite know as much as you thought you knew?
Oh, just about every job I've ever done.
All right. Well, we are in the same boat then.
It's hard to do something and not look back at it and say, hey, I could have done it better.
Yeah, definitely. But like, how do you, I mean, I've gotten to the point where I was just kind of not guessing, but I was at the edge of what I really knew. I mean, so how do you recognize that? I guess that's the real question, right?
It's hard. I mean, you study in engineering school and you try to learn the right equations and to know what to apply and what not to apply. But certainly when you're designing something new and it's not been done before, you've got to make some assumptions. You've got to make some guesses. You've got to try to do things within a realm of safe operation, but you're still trying to do things that have not been created before. And that makes it somewhat uncertain. The happiest time is for me was always when I saw a machine that I designed when it would, you know, start up and run because the thing actually ran.
Right. Yeah.
It wasn't like I had such confidence that I wasn't entirely sure that the thing would work. And even very simple mechanisms, I was never really confident that I'd gotten it right till I saw it working. So
yeah,
there's always that little question in the back of your mind: have you done the right thing?
Right. Yeah, and the age-old problem, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? I mean, if you're entering unknown territory, you don't really realize it until you're, you know, up to your knees, right?
Right. So, and I think all the evidence is that it's real easy to think you know more than you really do.
Yeah. And so, I mean, how do you deal with these situations then, right? I mean, because you could start wading into some waters that are not just dangerous from a, you know, ego perspective, but even a professional perspective or a safety perspective. So how do you kind of argue with yourself? How do you figure these things out, and how do you make judgment calls on these things, right?
Well, I think you have to have a good dose of skepticism about your own abilities. You know, you have to kind of walk around the job a few times and look at your design and say, hey, does this make sense? What have I forgotten? Talk to other people about it. Ask them, you know, not, hey, doesn't my design look good, but what have I forgotten?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a good dose of caution, I think.
Yeah. Caution and, you know, having a set of guidelines, right?
That helps. Certainly if you've got, you know, if you're designing a boiler and you can go to the ASME specs, well, that helps because you've got some written specs that people have already looked at and approved. But if you're doing something that's completely new, you don't have those to turn to.
Right. Well, I was actually speaking a little more general, though, and kind of on the field of ethics and how we're talking about that today.
Right.
The field of ethics. So who do we have today?
Well, today we're going to talk with Carl Steffen, who's a professor at Texas State University. How you doing, Carl?
Very good. How you doing?
Well, we're terrific. We're pleased that you were able to join us on the Engineering Commons podcast.
Yeah, thank
Glad
you for coming.
Here.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So, where's Texas? Well, I know where Texas State is, but for our listening audience, could you explain? I mean, Texas State, where is that located roughly?
It's halfway between Austin and San Antonio, in the edge of the Texas Hill Country.
All right, and I actually know that because I met my wife when she was attending that school.
That's a good place.
It is. It's great.
My wife and I went on a honeymoon at Aquarina Springs at Texas State.
You know, nice.
Many years ago.
That's great. And there's probably one of the best barbecue places not too far from there. Probably I would judge the best barbecue place in the world, called the Salt Lick.
It's one of the best, yes. We took my father-in-law to dinner not too long ago up there. It's still there. It's still very busy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, Carl, we're going to speak this evening some about engineering ethics, but when you're not conversing about engineering ethics, what are you teaching at Texas State?
I'm in our electrical engineering program, so I teach things like field and waves, circuits and devices, and basically analog electronics and electromagnetics.
Well, terrific.
That's my favorite field.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's what I do every day.
Wonderful.
Yeah. What about, so how did you get started in, I mean, in ethics? I mean, it's not necessarily, I mean, I think many engineers have to take that when they are going through university education in some form or another, but how did you get started teaching it, and how did you even start developing that stuff?
Well, it's been an interest of mine at some level for many years. Out of my faith background, I'm an evangelical Christian. I was interested in combining my interests in, religion and religious ethics and that sort of thing with my technical activities. Are you still hearing me? I heard a bing. I don't know.
Oh, we're still here.
Okay. Sorry about that. So, I was just interested in, looking at my profession from the viewpoint of my religion, if you want to put it that way. And on the top of it, it doesn't seem like there's, if you're in, for example, medicine or something, where you're dealing with people all the time and there's good and bad issues right in front of your face, it's not too hard to see how, ethical matters are a big deal in the particular profession of medicine or even law. But engineering, I mean, is there a, religious way to build a bridge versus a non-religious way to build a bridge? Or it just, a bridge is a bridge and mathematics are mathematics and so on.
Right.
Then I heard a talk by a fella named J.P. Moreland in the late 1990s. And he encouraged us to look at the specifically ethical aspects of whatever profession we were in. And I had the attitude at the time, I had heard of the phrase engineering ethics, but my impression of it was that it was sort of like a really obscure, specialized field, like, the people who design phase lock loops for microprocessors or something. Everybody just goes about their business most of the time. And then when you have an ethical problem, you go to the engineering ethics expert.
You call that guy, right?
Yeah, you call that guy. And that was the sense I had of it. And, I started reading some things. I joined the IEEE Society on Social Implications of Technology and got involved in that organization and started researching and just reading various places. I've had an interest in philosophy for some years, and so there's plenty of philosophical works on ethics of various kinds. And I found out that, well, no, everybody has some kind of ethics.
Right.
Whether you've gone to school or you have a PhD in philosophy or not, everybody has some idea of right and wrong. I mean, unless you're just, a psychopath or something. And there's not too many psychopaths in engineering. I won't talk about management. I began to realize that, this is something that's really pretty widely applicable, and every engineer ought to have some basic exposure to ethics. So this was back when I was in Massachusetts in the late 1990s. One of the first things I did in the field was to do a survey of virtually all engineering schools in the United States to find out how many of them were teaching a course with ethics in the title. And it turned out there weren't that many of them that were requiring everybody to teach, or to every engineering student to take an engineering ethics course labeled as such.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was back in the days when all this data was on microfiche.
Right.
Before the internet got apparently made things easier, but actually it didn't in this regard. So I spent, several weeks going through this big box of microfiches, and fortunately it was organized pretty well. And I wrote up this paper and published it, and I got a few complimentary comments and several less than complimentary comments from schools which did not look so well on the survey. So,
Stirring the pot.
Stirred the pot, yeah. And so, that was one of my early experiences. And being on the board of the Society for Social Implications of Technology, I got to meet a lot of people who did this full time, people who teach ethics, you know, in philosophy departments or whatever.
Right.
And so it just kind of went on from there. And I've published not too many papers in the area, but a few. And I had the opportunity for a couple of years here at Texas State to teach an ethics module. We had a one-credit freshman course, which we focused on engineering, and I taught some engineering ethics there. And unfortunately, for various reasons, that's not something I teach anymore. But it was very enjoyable. And, you know, I'm still active in the field and in terms of interested in it and like that. But so that's a long answer to a short question.
So do you see, I mean, ethics is something that we talk about as a, you know, a societal issue. But do you see any difference between the ethics that engineers talk about, engineering ethics, and ethics is sort of a more general subject?
Well, ethics almost implies a profession or some sort of a specialized situation or a particular group of people. When there, some people make a distinction between morals and ethics. Mm-hmm. You know, doing something immoral, this means it's wrong. Anybody would say it's wrong, pretty much. An unethical thing implies that you're in some sort of professional activity, you know, a recognized field of economics or enterprise of some kind, and you've done something that violates the understood codes of behavior in that field. So engineering ethics has to do with the codes of behavior for engineers.
Right.
And engineers, with their specialized knowledge, have positions of responsibility that your average citizen does not hold. People trust engineers to know more about certain special topics than the average man on the street or woman on the street. Mm-hmm. And with that special knowledge comes added responsibility of using it in a correct and ethical way.
Okay.
Does that answer the question?
So yeah, kind of with great power comes great responsibility, one of those arguments.
Yeah, that's a short way of saying it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. How, you mentioned that survey you did at the beginning. Have you done any surveys since? I mean,
I tried another survey with the assistance of a graduate student 5 or 6 years ago, but we ran into two difficulties. They don't publish the microfiches anymore. And the data was in a much more diffuse and difficult to access form. That was one problem. So I ended up doing a mail survey, and my return on the mail surveys was pretty low.
Yeah.
And I got some really irate letters from that, let me tell you. The other problem was the journal I published it in had gone into a more specialized direction, which basically meant that I had to have some theory about the whole thing and do a lot of stuff that I wasn't doing. And so the outlet was not there. So the short answer, no, I haven't done it. But my sense is that the situation has improved somewhat. ABET, the Accreditation Agency for Engineering, changed its criteria around 2000, which slightly emphasized the teaching of engineering ethics more than it used to.
Okay.
And that's had some positive effect on whether schools mention ethics in any class or even require a set of, you know, a standalone course in ethics.
Yeah. Well, I would, you know, I know it's early in the program to be asking people to write in about this, but I would be very interested if our listeners, you know, could write in to see if they've taken classes in this field and when they took them too. I think that would be an interesting data point. Obviously, it's,
it would. Yeah, I haven't done anything from kind of the other end just to see, you know, if you took an ethics course in college, has it done you any good? I'd love to know that.
Yeah, and that's an even better question. I'm sure it's, you know, because if you take a class and you forget it all, who cares, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What kind of reception have you had for these classes? I mean, in your experience, you've taught a couple of these 1 hour courses now, or 1 credit courses now, and
right.
What is the general student reception to the whole thing?
They are generally positive. It's nothing real rigorous. The form I taught it in, it was like, you know, 4 to 6 3-hour classes or something. It was a very abbreviated course. It wasn't even a full, you know, semester long course. But, you know, I caused this, then they were freshman students. They were just beginning engineers. So they had generally very positive receptions. Teaching ethics is not as straightforward as you might think. You may believe it's just, you know, a guy stands up in the front of the class and lays out a bunch of rules and tells you to do it that way, and that's the end of the class. That's not the way I teach it. I begin by kind of elucidating what people's worldview is. Like, do you think there's a God? Do you think the God cares about how you act? Do you think, you know, there's nothing but material things? And I kind of, you know, lead them in a worldview exercise just for them to be aware of what they really believe. And then if they do express some, you know, faith interest, I point out to them that, you know, most religious faiths have a lot to say about right and wrong and ethics. And so, you know, I kind of encourage them to fall back on their own religious resources if they have any. And even the people who don't, I say, well, you know, there's a lot of philosophers who have ideas about right and wrong. And so, you know, I get them thinking about it. And then we typically go through some simple cases. And the case study method is probably the best single educational tool in teaching engineering ethics. A real example. It doesn't have to be real in the sense of historical, but, you know, a story that has some ethical implications and quandaries. And the other thing that I use is some ethics videos produced by an organization I'm actually on the board of, the National Institute of Engineering Ethics. And these videos present the story of an engineer facing a number of ethical dilemmas, and we can stop the video and have the class discuss, well, gee, should Joe do this or that or whatever. So that's the format. And yeah, I enjoyed that class more than almost any other class I've taught in the last few years. It was very enjoyable.
Yeah.
And I've had a few students who took it earlier come back and tell me they appreciated it. So I think it was a positive experience for most people.
I hear that's one of the best parts of teaching.
it hardly ever happens, but when it does, people come tell you they liked it. It's very rewarding.
Yeah. So that's another thing for our listening audience to do.
Yeah,
go tell your teachers you appreciated them, because they probably helped you a lot.
Absolutely.
Now, is there I've never taken a classical ethics course. I mean, I know there are some based on philosophy, right? I mean, is there a lot of crossover? I mean, I know Jeff asked you this a little bit earlier, but in the actual practical teaching of it, do they also do case studies? Is that the same kind of thing, or
are you just talking about like a standard ethics course out of a philosophy?
Yeah.
It depends on the course. It's kind of a scale. On the one end, there is moral philosophy, which is philosophy. And there's all kinds of theories and people like Kant and Hegel and Nietzsche and so forth. And it can be rather dry unless you just like that sort of thing and like to argue, because philosophers argue almost as much as lawyers do. On the other end is the kind of thing I do. An engineer learns a little bit about, you know, enough about the philosophy of ethics to at least teach it to freshmen. And then we go through a bunch of cases. The best ethics courses are taught by teams of a philosopher and an engineer. And that's, you know, you have to be a pretty big school to have the resources to do that. But one of the schools that has done the best job is Texas A&M, and they have had a required course, a standalone engineering ethics course for all their engineers for many years. And a number of philosophers and engineering professors have worked together and published textbooks. And that's probably the optimum situation, but not too many schools have the resources or inclination to do that.
Right. Yeah, you need to focus on both, right?
Right.
So is the reaction from students then that they kind of enjoy the conversation of a subject where there are many accurate or right viewpoints? You can argue about these things, and it's sort of a messier topic than, say, you know, calculus or circuit analysis?
Yeah. I had my students write a little paper, and it was quite interesting to read the papers. And I allowed them to choose the topic, which, of course, made them more motivated to write about it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they got to say things about matters that they cared about, which isn't always the case in strictly, you know, technical engineering courses. And so that helped them talk about it. And I didn't run into a lot of frustration. I mean, you have the stereotype of an engineer who wants the one right answer.
Yeah.
But anybody who has spent enough time in engineering knows that unless you're dealing with a textbook problem, and sometimes not even then, there is no such thing as the one right answer to a complex enough engineering problem,
right,
even if you're talking technically. So I didn't run into a lot of problems of people being frustrated that there was not one unique right answer. And they appreciated the fact that, you know, there's a range of things, and you could, if you had a new piece of information that would possibly change the whole complexity or the whole picture of the problem, and what looked like right in the first place is now not so right, and so forth. Because mm-hmm. we're always deciding these things based on incomplete information.
Always.
And the art of it is to know when you have enough incomplete information to proceed.
Right. Right. Have you done any surveys or work with people in industry to see how they view ethics or what part of a role they think it plays in their day-to-day activities?
Unfortunately, no, I have not. I have not got a lot of industrial contacts, and there's other people I know who have done things like that, but I have not personally done that, no.
Well, like you said, we tend to think of engineers as the guys that sort of have their heads down and are working on the technical problem and perhaps don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about the societal implications of what they're doing. And so I don't know whether that's – at this point, I just don't know whether that's something that's really a problem or it's something that we really need to address as a profession.
Well, one way of thinking of this is a distinction that a friend of mine who teaches ethics full time named Joseph Herkert at the University of Arizona, is it Arizona State? He's at either Arizona State or University of Arizona. I believe it's Arizona State. Anyway, Joseph Herkert has a useful distinction between what he calls microethics and macroethics.
Mm-hmm.
Microethics is what you usually encounter in an engineering ethics course. Here is you, the engineer, you have an ethical dilemma. Your boss has told you to sign off on some test results that you know are fake in order to not lose the company a contract that if they lose it, it'll go broke, he tells you. That is a microethical dilemma. But it's micro in the sense that it's you in this local situation. And it doesn't have a lot of broader implications for society.
Mm-hmm.
Macroethics is addressing the question such as, should we put a big carbon tax on all fossil fuels so that, you know, the world won't turn into a toaster?
Right.
And I'm not taking any position on that, but I'm just giving that as an example of a macroethical problem, which is also very technical. I mean, you know, there's a lot of technology and economic trade-offs involved in that question.
Right.
So, the typical engineer who is doing engineering and is not yet in management, or if you're in management, you're not managing a big bunch of people. There's not a lot of things you can do personally in your job about macro ethical problems. You certainly can deal with micro ethical problems, and you may face those from time to time. But, It's the microethics matters that the average working engineer encounters most of the time. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I really appreciate the distinction between the micro and macro. I'd never really thought of it that way.
Yeah, that is a helpful distinction. What about, I mean, so turning outward from the classroom setting, I mean, I'm guessing you've probably been consulted on this kind of stuff before, but... And I guess I'm sure you covered these micro and macro type things in the classroom as well, but what are some of the hot button issues? I mean, like, where are our audience likely to see some of these micro and macro ethical issues?
Well, in the future, I was able to contribute to an article in a 100-year anniversary proceeding of the IEEE journal here. It came out in May, I think. And one of the interesting topics, I didn't think of it, but one of the other co-authors did, is the issue of implanted chips in your body. Yeah. There's a nice specific topic.
Yes, very.
And there's all sorts of ethical questions about that sort of thing.
There's a whole other field of bioethics as well. Actually, one of my friends was a bioethics PhD for a while.
Okay, yeah. And they decided to do something else?
Yeah, he decided. but I mean, the fact that there is a whole other field there, just not on the electronic side, on the bio side.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's any profession has its ethical aspects. So I'm trying to address your question more specifically. And you're talking about hot button issues.
Well, you mentioned energy is another one. I mean,
energy,
military type focus,
absolutely.
Maybe.
Let's see. Computer and communications and, you know, information technology, security, those
privacy,
sorts of things.
That kind of thing.
Privacy.
Yeah.
Those are the main ones. I was looking through the back issues of the Technology and Society magazine that IEEE's SSIT publishes. And the articles fell into about three categories, energy, military and security kind of things, and computers and communication stuff. I may have forgotten one or two, but I think those are the main categories. So, you know, there's numbers of specific topics within those broad issues, but that covers a lot of it.
Okay. So are those mostly macro then? Are they...
They can be, but certainly if you're working on, you know, a chip that is definitely going to be implanted in somebody, I mean, somebody's going to design that chip, right? And you got to ask yourself, do I like what they're going to do when they put this chip in that person's body? A lot of people will not work on military projects, and that's their right to choose to do that, but it gets difficult. I was looking at an article in a magazine today that shows most of the nation's R&D funding in the federal government goes to military R&D. And so if you tell yourself you're not going to work on military R&D, you're cutting yourself out of a good bit of possible jobs. You know, I think the point where certainly graduating engineers just going into the job market face an ethical choice is, what company are you going to work for, and do you like what they do? You know, if it's a chip maker, I mean, chips can be used for everything. That's sort of morally neutral. Mm-hmm. If it's a video game producer, there's a little more of an ethical angle to video games. I think you could agree. Mm-hmm. If it's a medical company, there's specific issues regarding, you know, medical equipment that if people cut corners or, you know, do something wrong, you get into problems real fast there. On the other hand, you can probably go home with an extra special warm glow if you're working on a company whose products save lives. That's not true of every company. And so, you know, there's positives and negatives. But the choice of the business and the, you know, field you go into, it's not just the most dollars for the least amount of work, you know. It's how you're going to be spending the bulk of your time for many years. And you will, when you're older, you're going to want to be able to look back and think, gee, you know, our company's product has benefited X number of people in so many ways, or maybe not, you know.
Right.
So that's a point that maybe at least younger engineers don't consider the ethical implications of their choice of jobs, assuming they have a choice of job. I mean, that isn't always true either. You know, I have a student who graduated last May. He's still looking for work, you know. But
when you
have a choice, it's nice. You
know? There's actually that Daniel Pink talk on, it was a TED talk, I believe, and it was it was then animated, but basically it's all about drive and like what drives people.
Okay.
And, see if I can remember them. Mastery, like self-drivenness, and then purpose, basically. And purpose is actually a rising trend in terms of employment. What motivates people in their jobs is purpose. And so that kind of speaks to what you're talking about.
Right.
He actually said it's more so for older employees who have a little bit more financial freedom and can actually make those distinctions. But I've seen that as well in terms of, the younger people wanting to work in green energy and stuff like that. There seems like there's a very strong drive for wanting to make a difference and that speaks to their ethical decisions behind that.
Yeah, I spoke at an ethics conference at the Texas A&M branch in Qatar close to a year ago now, last October, and met a gentleman who talked about the fact that many of their engineering graduates, I forget exactly what school he was at, I could remember in a while, but anyway, a lot of their engineering graduates are looking at companies that have been founded intentionally on a nonprofit basis just to do good, but they're engineering company. And this is a very, apparently a pretty growing segment of the employment market. I mean, it's pretty small compared to everything else, but those outfits used to be few and far between, and now they're actually, engineering nonprofits that exist primarily just to, benefit society in some way.
Yeah, there's actually a new class of called a B Corporation. Instead of a S Corp or C Corp, there's a B Corp, which is somewhere between a nonprofit and a for profit.
Yeah,
but it's probably meant for societal change.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure that's something a lot of people can relate to as well, because I mean, we all had to make that decision at some point. And so, when you're advising students, what about on some of the extreme side of things? So, I mean, hot button issue might be working as an explosives expert, right? I mean, like that is one where some people make that decision, right? And that's
what
that's
kind
always
of explosives? I mean, for destroying buildings as a part of demolition, or
no? I meant like
or destroying buildings as part of war.
Yeah, I meant more in a war context, because that's probably a pretty touchy thing, right? I mean,
Well, I mean, that's. I have never had a student come up to me and ask me point blank, should I go to work for this company that blows up people? probably don't want me to know.
Right.
I almost don't try to, tell them absolutely not. I'm not that kind of a person. I'm rather low key and not, bossy, I hope. And I haven't had that issue come up, but there are a lot of war-related activities that are morally questionable by some people anyway. I personally am a little troubled by the ease with which we are blowing up people on the other side of the world from a little office in Miami where some guy is sitting there and the worst danger he's in is a paper cut, This is a relatively new thing in war. It's been coming for the last 100 years or so, with the invention of the airplane and the aerial bombing. A fellow flying a bomber was not perfectly safe, but he was a lot more safe than the people underneath him. And so we've been moving in the direction of, remote control killing. And I think we've kind of reached the ultimate, where you're literally halfway around the world in a different country. And there isn't a lot of discussion about that. And I think history is not going to judge us kindly. Let's put it that way. Mm. I don't know how history is going to judge us or when, but I think it's going to come back and possibly bite us in some way. I don't know.
Well, so if you were discussing that kind of issue in class, then, I mean, what or even in this SSIT society, what kind of analysis? I mean, maybe this is too extreme an example because we already – I think many people would agree with you on that, but I mean, what are some of the considerations you'd have when you're approaching a problem like this, right? I mean,
there are things with this specific problem. There's a thing called just war theory, and that comes out of Aristotelian and Catholic and Thomistic philosophy. And it is sort of a set of rules of how to tell whether a war is just or not and how to fight a war justly and so forth. Not everybody subscribes to it, obviously, or there would be only just wars, right?
Right.
And so, but you have to believe that that moral framework is valid in order to even listen to it. We are live in a pluralistic society, meaning many people who believe in many sorts of different things are rubbing up against each other and getting along more or less pretty well. And so it is not, I don't think, my business to tell everybody else how to behave in every way. I have my own beliefs in how they ought to behave. And if they ask my advice, I'll certainly give it to them freely. But, you know, the thing about ethical issues in an engineering context is that there's nothing like Maxwell's equations to fall back on. You know, there's no experimentally tested 100% works all the time rules to apply. That's one thing that students do tend to do is they say, okay, tell us the rules and we'll go out and apply them.
Okay.
It's yeah. not that simple.
Right.
I mean, there are rules about certain things, but you just, you know, if there were rules and they were specific enough, a computer could do it. And no computer I'm aware of does very well in solving ethical problems.
Interesting.
Right. There was a episode on Radiolab within the past, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks that I listened to was talking about how the color blue didn't come up in most languages until the society had developed for a while, that you'd in the literature, there'd be the word black or there'd be the word white. And
they refer to sky as red, right? In a couple of Homer references, I believe.
Yeah. But you go, they were going through the Odyssey and the Iliad and saying, you know, the word blue never showed up, you know, in the entire thing. And they're talking about the word blue doesn't show up until the society figures out how to make blue things. They know, they figured out how to dye things blue, and then they need that term. And the people that they were interviewing on the show were talking about how some tribe they had found that didn't know the word blue, didn't have the word blue. They could show them images that were partially green and partially blue, and they would ask them to distinguish between them. And they couldn't distinguish because they didn't have that word for it. The lack of having the language for it made them unable to, I mean, they could see, I mean, their eyesight was fine, but they had no sense of needing to distinguish. And so when you're talking about students wanting something clear and defined, I think this is part of it. That's probably why the case studies work so well, is until you talk about it, until you discuss it, until you see how messy it is and how it's a very fine gradient between the blues and the greens. If you've never really thought about it before, it would seem to me you almost have to have that conversation to be able to recognize that there are some issues there.
That's a very good point and a very good analogy. I had not heard that about the word blue, but it makes sense. If you have no word or concept of a thing, it's very hard to discuss it. And, you know, philosophy has a bad reputation compared to more technical fields because we are still currently discussing in philosophy circles the same questions that Aristotle was talking about X thousand years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so by comparison, it looks like, gee, they're not getting anywhere. However, they have developed a lot of very exact terms for rather complex issues, including moral and ethical issues. And that, to me, is one of the best reasons I read philosophy, is that it gives you words to talk about these issues that are just kind of out there, and you're in the middle of it, but you don't know how to describe it otherwise.
Huh. Right. Could you give us an example of that?
I was afraid you're going to say that.
Yeah, well, I've obviously not read a lot of philosophy, so that's the reason behind it.
Well, let me just give you a recent thing I read.
Okay.
There's a philosopher who's dead now, named, and I'm not a good French pronouncer either, Yves Simon, YvesSimon.
Okay.
And he wrote a very good little book on authority. Now, authority, I mean, it means you can look it up in the dictionary and so forth, is a fine word. But he makes a point, and other people have too, that authority has gotten mixed up in our culture with a similar but not identical concept called authoritarianism. And during the middle part of the 20th century, when a lot of authoritarian governments, such as in Germany and Russia and China, were doing very bad things, authoritarianism got a bad name, and deservedly so. But following that, and especially in the 60s, people started lumping authority in with authoritarianism and throwing the whole thing out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this classic bumper sticker, question authority, right, was very popular and still is popular in some circles.
Right.
And the points Simone makes is that authority is not a bad thing. In fact, it's impossible to conceive of any well-functioning society, even one composed of intelligent and good-willed people, where some form of authority is not necessary. Just to tell everybody, you know, hey, we're all going to go do this. The example he uses is a symphony orchestra, or another writer uses it. You got a great oboist over here, a great violinist over there, a great percussion player, but each of them by themselves, you know, it's rather limited what they can do. And if they just all get together in a room and stare at each other, you know, unless they, you know, are excellent improvisationalists, they're not going to make anything very nice. So the conductor has to be the authority to get the entire symphony to play Beethoven's Fifth or whatever. So authority is fundamentally a necessary and good function of a society that works well. Now, that's a little bit of philosophy there. Was it? Did it hurt?
It stings a little, but it's I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay.
Yeah. You'll get over it. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay.
but this was something totally new to me. I'd never heard of this guy, but I'm thinking of writing a paper about this and authority in engineering, not engineering ethics. But you know, until I read that, I really didn't have those ideas. But
yeah.
I had been facing some situations which gave me some mental indigestion, but I didn't have the words or the terminology or the mental structure to deal with. But once I read this guy's book, I thought, aha, that's what's going on. And I could express it.
Right. So it's a pattern recognition, and then you being able to use that pattern recognition as a construct for whatever you're then talking about in the future, right?
I can tell you're an engineer. Yeah. pattern recognition is fine if that's how you want to think about it. Yeah, there's a pattern out there, but you don't have a term for it.
Right. Yeah.
All engineers know that it is possible to think without words.
Yes.
You talk to a lot of humanities people, they believe it's not possible to think without words. But it's also helpful to think with words.
Right. Well, sometimes we think with numbers or, you know, diagrams or whatever else.
Exactly, yeah. But I'm just saying both of them are helpful, that's all.
Oh, right. Yes. Huh.
So the whole topic of engineering ethics usually arises in the general public and in the press and that kind of stuff after there's been some sort of failure. A bridge goes down or a building collapses or something explodes.
Yes, a friend of mine used to summarize engineering ethics in two words: no headlines. And so, yeah, I mean, that's usually where when something goes wrong. And that gets into I think you're going to ask me a question. Engineering ethics can be a grim business. Why did I say that? The examples you're making. When something goes wrong, it hits the headlines, and then you start getting questions and who was to blame and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Right. You don't see any headlines about, oh, what a great decisions those engineers made 50 years ago when they were planning out this bridge. No one publishes that on a Tuesday, right?
No, that's not how it happens. And you know, that's where, if you ever read any of Henry Petrosky's work, he makes the point that that's how engineering advances, largely through failure. You hope that the failures are not, you know, too serious or fatal. And one of the most important things an engineer can do is to notice little almost failures, because if you go into the history of a major disaster involving a complex system, whether it's electrical, mechanical, computer, whatever, and if you go back far enough, you usually find places where it almost happened before it really did happen. You know, if five different things had to go wrong for it to blow up, probably three of them went wrong. Excuse me. Probably three of them went wrong, you know, several times, and the other two went wrong some other time. And finally, all five of them went wrong and it blew up. But if you had looked at the three times and the two times and asked yourself, gee, what if these happened at the same time? We're going to be in big trouble. You could have stopped it.
So is that just because the true coincidences, if they do exist, is it they're just not interesting ethical questions because it's just happenstance? The five things happened at once, just because the five things happened at once.
Well,
is that not an interesting question ethically?
Well, it's an interesting motivator for people to be aware of near accidents. And that's the ethics part of it.
Okay.
Well, the very, very classic example that's in every engineering textbook I know of.
I know it's coming.
Go ahead, tell me.
The O-ring failure, right?
Yes, yes.
Every time.
You're psychic.
Yes.
It was a problem. They knew it was a problem.
Yep.
The late now Roger Beaujolais was convinced it was going to kill somebody someday. And they had several near accidents that burned almost all the way through. And they were doing the right thing, but, you know, NASA at the time as an organization dropped the ball and there went the astronauts. So, the point of these multiple incidences is that is often how major disasters happen. A number of separate things go wrong. And it's not an attitude thing, really. If an engineer has the attitude of, okay, well, you know, little things go wrong every so often, I shouldn't worry about it, and just totally blows off minor problems, that's probably not a good mental habit to get into, because you have to have the imagination of, okay, it's a minor problem, but, you know, if enough minor problems combine, we could have a major disaster. And that takes a little more thought than just blowing off minor problems.
Right.
Does that mean we should all be pessimists or just realists?
I think every good engineer likes thinking of worst case scenarios.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And yes. So pessimistic in the sense of, you know, what is the worst possible thing that can reasonably go wrong here? I think that's just a basic responsible attitude for engineers, because they're not going, nobody else is going to think of that. The salesmen aren't going to think of that, you know.
Right. Right.
Nothing against salesmen, okay, but their whole orientation is to put the bright side on whatever's going on, at least toward the customer. And the engineer's job is to think, oh, gee, you know, if this goes really wrong, what's the worst that can happen? Now, right. Does that mean you're doom and gloom and nothing will ever go right? Of course not. But so pessimist isn't quite the right word. But okay. I would say, you know, realist, including the worst case scenarios. That's what an engineer ought to be.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that is experience, too. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I think I've seen a little more cynicism from my older colleagues, and sometimes they call them on it, and they just go, "You just wait, buddy.
Right,
you just
right.
wait." And I know they're right; they totally
yeah.
are right. You know, they've seen it all. They've been there at 11 p.m. on a on Friday
yeah.
night. You
yeah.
know, fixing
well,
something.
It's a very valuable thing to hang around older engineers to a reasonable extent. You know, because you know that's how the whole process keeps going. Older people teaching younger people about what happened and telling war stories and. It's very entertaining, and you can learn something, too. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And without doing it, you're bound to repeat the mistake. So, yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just add that one of the downsides of being a realist is from time to time you'll be accused of not being a team player because
well,
they'll ask your opinion, and you'll give them an honest opinion, and it isn't what they wanted to hear.
It sounds like a Dilbert cartoon. You know?
Well.
Can I mention Dilbert on that?
You sure can.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're the only engineer in the room, it's going to be hard to be a team player. I mean, you know, because you are going to have a perspective that nobody else has. And although engineers can say what can happen, they can also say what can't happen or won't happen, and nobody else can. And of course, you're going to probably bring some negative news that some other people don't want to hear, but that's why you're an engineer. I mean, that's what they pay you for.
Right. Right. Is there some level, I don't know if risk assessment is a separate topic from ethics, or whether you have to sort of join them, because as an engineer, you're often asked to evaluate risk. You know, is the thing going to work or isn't going to work? Can we have it done in time or not have it done? Will it come in budget or not come in budget?
Well, risk assessment is almost a different field. I mean, in a sense, it's a subset of engineering ethics, although it's actually a specialized technical specialty all its own. And actually, NASA is supposedly one of the leaders in risk assessment, but that you can kind of judge that for however you want to do it. Risk is an important aspect of doing engineering ethically. There is some risk in virtually everything you do. Some fields of engineering inherently deal with risk more than others. If you're designing the next dental floss, you know, the ways people can hurt themselves with dental floss is a lot more limited than if you are working on the next nuclear power plant.
All right.
You know, you're going to have to be a lot more rigorous deciding what can go wrong and what the chances are and so forth with the nuclear power plant than you will be with the dental floss. But it's an inexact science. You know, you can, as they found out in Japan, when that combination of earthquake and tsunami hit the nuclear plants and did things that they didn't expect. You know, I'm sure that they had a lot of risk assessment and paperwork and all that, and it didn't work. So, you know, but it's irresponsible not to do it, but it doesn't. If you've done a nice, wonderful, neat-looking risk assessment, that doesn't mean you're always going to be right.
True. So what about those kind of really huge examples too? I mean, like with the Challenger explosion, they took it back to a certain failure in terms of communication and everything. I don't remember what the nuclear plant in Japan was. Fukushima. But if that was taken back to a specific point. But like, what about with really large systems? I mean, because in those kind of cases, it's hard to point to one spot, right? I mean, there's
a tendency to find quote unquote the cause in some of these things,
right?
And that it's a little bit like trying to find the inventor of a particular technology. And the fact of the matter may be that several people had similar ideas at almost the same time. And it doesn't really matter that much unless you're fighting a patent battle or something. And, you know, then it's just a matter of the lawyers. It's certainly important to get a good picture of the sequence of events. And, you know, finding critical paths, decisions. I'm recalling that, for example, there was some issue about where they stored the used nuclear fuel in the Japanese nuclear plants. It was either too high or too low or something. I don't know. But there was some basic decision they made, which in retrospect was not a good decision. Did that make the whole thing happen if they had just made that one thing different? Would that have fixed everything? No. But it's certainly a lesson to learn. And so, especially the way the media, the popular media, treat engineering disasters, they frame it as, you know, investigators are still seeking the cause of the incident. You know? And it's an oversimplification in many cases. But what you want to do is get an overall picture and a good understanding of all the important things that went wrong, but you may never find a particular cause that was make or break.
Right. Yeah, it could have been one operator didn't get sleep the night before because his kid kept him up or something, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
there's
always unknown variables and such.
Yeah.
You know, because one of our listeners had written in about just the complexity of modern systems and just I mean, he wrote in about where the blame lies, but I think just in general, like we were just talking about, I mean, how do you separate all these things? And I guess prevention is the real key there. It's, you know, blame is a post thing, but
that's
prevention
what I say about looking for the near accidents. If you're very vigilant in catching near accidents and stopping them, if you do a good enough job, you're going to greatly decrease the chance of a big real accident.
Right. And Carl, you talked earlier about the young engineers needing to choose where they go work. And I think part of that is choosing what the culture is of where they're going to work, because
absolutely,
so much of this is the culture of the company. If the company is all about, let's get the product out the door and let's make money without worrying about what are the safety issues or what are the, you know, more societal implications of what we're doing. These little indicators that you're talking about probably aren't going to get paid much attention to.
Right. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to pick up what the culture of an outfit is in 2 days of interviews.
Right.
You usually have to work there for a while to find out. And by then it's possibly too late. I mean, you know, they don't take kindly about people quitting 6 weeks after they join the company, you know. But there's some times when it's so obvious that you can really tell. I interviewed for a job at a university, which shall remain nameless.
Right.
And the department chair, I started thinking a little bit like I was in North Korea or something. He was issuing orders to professors right and left. Get this thing out here. And I thought, you know, I don't really want to work here. I don't care what they want me to do. So, yeah. Sometimes it's just obvious. And you should go by your first impressions if you just cannot stand the place, you know. But usually you have to be working with them and dealing with people for a while before you get a sense of the culture. And, you know, if it's terrible enough, you should quit even later. But it just takes a while. Yeah, and companies vary all over the place. There's wonderful places to work. Everybody's happy. Everybody's doing the right thing. One difficulty just generally about the engineering world now is I was talking to you before we started the program, and one of you was working for a company that was nice till it was bought. You know, well, name me a company that hasn't been bought recently.
The
rapidity with which ownership changes and upper management gets shifted around,
and value shift, right?
And values can shift really fast, you know, and so you just have to keep your eyes open, and if a place is just not where you feel like you can look yourself in the mirror before going to work, maybe it's not the right place for you.
Yeah. And what are some other, I mean, I guess another classic, response to a breach in one's own ethics would be, I mean, one is to leave the company where it's happening, right? I mean, I guess it... What else is there, though? I mean, like reporting to certain bodies? I mean, I guess...
Well, there's the whistleblowing sequence, if I could go through that briefly. Yeah. If, say, your boss asks you to do something you know is wrong, you first confront your boss directly. Tell him, I don't think I should do that. If your boss doesn't listen, then you go to your boss's boss. And you respect the chain of command insofar as it's your ability to do so, and, you know, you can carry that, depending on how big the chain is, you know, obviously, right, if there's seven people and the CEO is inaccessible to anybody but two people in the world, you can't go that far. But only after you've exhausted internal possibilities do you consider going to an outside agency, whether it's a federal regulatory outfit. Almost the last thing you do is go to the media, because it's like, you know, turning on a fire hose to get a drink. You don't know where that's going to go.
Yeah.
And so...
right in your face, that's where it goes.
Yeah. So,
every time.
But, you know, the direct confrontation of the person who is telling you to do the wrong thing is always the first thing to do in those cases.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll say, well, Dern, you're right. You know, they'll surprise you. But, you work inside the outfit as much as possible before you go outside.
Yeah.
But then somehow you have to go outside. And, you know, unfortunately, whistleblowers, they're almost always fired, they almost always lose all their friends, not only in the company, but sometimes in the industry. And it's a very, very traumatic thing, which is, you don't want to do it if you can possibly help it. But right. sometimes you have to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Right. You had talked earlier, Carl, about the value of young engineers learning from older engineers.
Yeah.
But you'd also put together a blog post a couple years ago that talked about that we might eventually run out of engineers.
Yes, that was one of my wilder speculations. it has to do with this purely intuitive. I'm not a social scientist, obviously. And so please take everything I say from this point on with a grain of salt.
Okay.
Several grain. But
I only brought it up because I just thought it was such an interesting thought process as I hadn't considered it before.
Yeah. Well, my thought is along those lines is that the engineering personality has to have certain characteristics, attention to detail, self-discipline, ability to work a fairly extended amount of time and think complex sequential thoughts and some other things, you know. And wouldn't it be a shame if, for whatever reason, a particular culture or society or country, for whatever reason, quit producing those kinds of people?
Right.
Now, I have no idea how that would happen. I'm not saying it's happening in the U.S. I don't know. Because we're still having plenty of people apply to our engineering program, and many of them graduate. So, you know.
That's great.
We aren't having problems. But, you know, there's nothing automatic about, you know, getting every year a bunch of people who are suited to be engineers. It's a blessing from God, if you want to look at it that way. We don't know how it happens. We don't know how to make more engineers. NSF thinks it knows how to make more engineers, but I tend to disagree with them, with all these special programs and so forth, National Science Foundation.
Are you of the mind that engineers tend to come, if you want to use the Myers-Briggs as sort of a personality scale?
Oh, I like the Myers-Briggs.
Myers-Briggs, that engineers tend to come out of, you know, the INTJ or some variant nearby from there.
That's me.
Which composes...
Let's see. INTJ. I think I'm an INTJ, too. Is that what they call the executive?
That's ENTJ, actually. Oh. INTJ is the engineer or the scientist.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm somewhere in there. These poor people listening, they don't know what we're talking about, INTJ and so forth. You're going to have to explain that.
Right. So
I got a book somewhere.
Well, I'm trying to.
I is introverted and is.
Versus extroverted.
Right.
Intuitive.
I got a
intuitive.
Card right here.
Sensing.
Official Myers-Briggs category. Let's see. Oh, yeah. ENTJ is leaders, 5%, Winston Churchill. INTJ is executives, Arthur C. Clarke, 1%. I think I test out is more INTJ than anything else.
Yeah, that's my that's where I am.
Mm-hmm. And I is introvert. N is intuiting. T is thinking. J is judging. There you go.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I'm not a professor, it turns out.
You're in the wrong category.
Yeah, I'm in the wrong category. Yeah. I like to do a thing and be finished with it and gone on to the next thing. The professors will fiddle with it forever. And I've known most of the people I work with are that way. They fiddle with it forever. It drives me crazy. Anyway.
So are you of the mindset that these INTJs or something near that are, say, 5 or 10% of the population, and it's silly to think that we're going to make 30% of the population engineers?
That's a very good way of putting it. I couldn't put it better myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, industry always says there's a shortage of engineers unless there's a recession.
Right.
And
oh, yeah.
So, you know, then there's all this pressure, let's make more engineers. We're constantly running out of engineers. You know, there it may be some genetic thing, or I don't know how it happens, but
it's the knack.
Well, yeah, but there's usually just a certain percentage of the public who's getting to educatable age that are suitable to be engineers. And I'm not even going to talk about how many of those are women and how many are men, because you don't have another hour. But you know, there's they can probably make you know, slight changes around the edges. A few people who wouldn't have been engineers might go into engineering if there's some special school program or other. But they're not going to make huge changes. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Right. But I'm sure they'll spend a lot of money along the way trying
to
prove
us wrong. They already have, and they will continue.
Well, we might have to have a knockdown drag out. We can have our episode 9 guests who were doing STEM education. We have them come back on and talk about that with Carl. That'd be good.
Yeah, debates. That could be quite interesting.
We could. Yeah, we could get like 17 people on this thing.
Oh, I can't listen to 17 people at once.
I know. Well, we'd have to moderate, but
good luck.
Yeah.
Right. Well, one of the things about ethics that when I was younger, I always saw it as being just a gray area. I kind of shied away from it the same way I shied away from biology.
So because did
I. It just seemed very messy to me, and I liked the thought of if you were doing, you know, mechanical engineering, you had bearings and you had parts, and if you're doing electrical engineering, you know, you had wires, and you know, there wasn't all this gore and there wasn't all this mess. And ethics seemed like an awful messy subject. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that usually when you find yourself in these ethical situations, it kind of creeps up on you. It isn't like it comes with a big sign and says, hey, ethical problem ahead, be careful. You're suddenly in the midst of it and starting to think, well, how is it that I got here and what do I need to do now?
That's a great description of how it often happens. And, you know, what we hope to do in engineering ethics courses or modules or mentions or whatever, however you're exposed to it, is to help you look for these warning signs or issues or whatever you want to call them and have already thought of what you're going to do before you're in the middle of it. That's one of the great things about case studies. You can pretend that you are an engineer in a nuclear power plant and you have to make this critical decision and the lives of thousands are at stake. Then the bell rings and you go home, you know, and have a beer or whatever. You don't have to worry about it for real, but you have already given a situation like that some thought. You may have the actual blessing of remembering it when you are in a similar situation in reality. And you will have had some mental practice in making a decision rather than having to start from scratch and go call your ethics professor from 20 years ago or whatever you have to do otherwise. You know.
Carl's number is
no, please. don't do that.
That's a really good point though about the having thought through that. I mean, those thought experiments are
some
crucial.
Of these things happen very fast. There's a deadline and the company, you know, Friday evening, and something happens Monday morning and they tell you to do this, and if you haven't said, you know, if this ever happens, I'm just going to tell him to, you know what. If you haven't made those mental preparations, you may be just caught flat-footed and you'll say something you'll regret.
Right. Yeah.
And engineers are oftentimes not privy to the conversations and communications going on at higher levels of management within the organization. So
that's right.
Something can be brewing for a while. And like you said, it gets to be Friday night and the numbers don't come in right and a decision is made. You know, somebody calls somebody on Saturday and all of a sudden you walk in on Monday morning and they're telling you, you know, you've got, we've only rated this machinery to run at, you know, 300 widgets per hour, but we want you to crank it up to 400.
Yeah. Right. Or sign a sheet of paper that's saying it will and it won't. Yeah.
Right. And they say, well, you put a safety factor of 2 on this thing, right? So we should be good to 600.
Yeah, we can use it up, can't we?
Right, exactly. And those are the kind of things that because we've come from an engineering mindset, we understand what that safety factor is for. But people who are not from that, the MBAs are spending all their time trying to pinch every penny that they possibly can. And so the thought that there's something remaining in the pipeline just drives them nuts.
Right, right. Don't tell them about it.
Efficiency. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
They don't know it can't do that. No, right. It can't. Well, I'm not saying a lie, but I mean, you know, there is, you do have a special expertise. And there are traditions of safety factors and so forth. And, you know, to the extent that they ask you what is your honest engineering opinion about a thing, that's what you're there for. And, you know, there are ways of telling people things that don't tell them absolutely everything. you know, but you can still get the job done, if that makes any sense.
Right.
Yeah. You give them the outward facing, you know, like if it, in terms of safety, right? I mean, you give them what is safe. You don't tell them what it can do. It's what is safe.
This is safe.
This is safe. Yeah.
Right. Right. So I just had this sudden thought. Can you have an ethical battle between the MBAs and the engineers? By the way, I have an MBA, so I'm not making fun of all MBAs. But
I'll be careful how I answer that one.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. No problem.
No, I make fun of MBAs all the time. Don't worry about it.
It's okay. But if it, does an MBA, we talked earlier about ethics being the you know, the professional norms, the codes of behavior. Does an MBA have an ethical duty to the people that they're paying his salary to crank every dollar out of the process? Whereas the engineer has other ethical interests, and so you could have a legitimate ethical battle between these two.
Both you're talking about basically different priorities, and that's perhaps what makes ethics so. If you want to use the term messy, you can. But and this is something that even is reflected in today's political environment. As you know, from a strictly technical point of view, most engineering is the practice of compromise.
Right.
You know, you turn up the gain, it have a lot of gain, but it'll be unstable. And it will, you know, when you know you have a compromise, you know you're doing engineering. Right. So that applies to a discussion between an MBA and an engineer. If you make the thing so safe that nobody will ever get killed if they use it for 10,000 years, it will weigh as much as a tank and cost 10 times as much as the competition, and it will go broke. Yeah. If, on the other hand, you make it the absolutely cheapest thing and it's, you know, 40% below the nearest competitor, it'll blow up as soon as you get inside. And so neither one of those extremes is right. There's a range in the middle where you want to go, and it's just a kind of a spitting contest or whatever as to decide where in the middle you go. Does that make any sense? Yeah, I mean, you're not going to be able to pull out a knockdown, drag out. You're not going to win the battle with the NBA. Right. You will have to compromise and agree, okay, I'll let you do this, but you can't do that. Right. And so, you know, and unfortunately, especially if you listen to politics these days, compromise is a dirty word. But it can't be a dirty word with engineering in the sense of, you know, trade-offs. I probably should be using the word trade-off rather than compromise. Compromise sounds like you could have done something well and you didn't do it quite as well. But trade-offs is really the best word for this. Right. You know, we trade off a little money here, but we can't trade that off because it'll be dangerous, you know.
Right, right.
So the conflict, you know, it's like the immovable object getting hit by the unstoppable force. Both of them have to give in order for it to be realistic.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, we should probably think of letting you go, Carl. You've been kind enough to spend some time with us. But
this has been a blast.
If somebody has some interest in learning more about engineering ethics, do you have any resources that you might recommend?
Oh, yes. I have my blog, and I guess I can read it out on the air or whatever this is.
Yeah. We'll put it in the show notes, but go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. http://, the usual business. All one word, engineeringethicsblog.blogspot.com. And if you Google engineering ethics blog, three words, it usually comes up somewhere on the first page.
That's how I find it.
Yeah. And, you know, I post something weekly. I don't say it's always worth reading, but I try to make it worth reading.
It usually is definitely worth reading. I enjoy your blog.
Well, thank you very much. And there's some other resources that I have noted here. Let me just talk about a few of them. There's onlineethics.org, which has some good resources. There's a nationalethicscenter.org, and it's a disciplinary thing, which has different disciplines, not just engineering. The Texas A&M ethics website is ethics.tamu.edu, and the organization of which I'm a board member is www.niee.org, the National Institute of Engineering Ethics. Those are the people who sell the videos.
Right. Okay.
How's that?
Terrific. Well,
it's a good list.
That is good. That is good. If someone has questions or wants to get a hold of you, is there any preferred contact information?
My email address is kdstefan@txstate.edu, and they can email me.
Terrific.
Yeah. That's awesome. Carl, thank you very much for, I mean, this has been enlightening for me. I'm definitely, I'm sad to say I was not subscribed to your blog before, but I am now.
Oh,
so,
great. Well, thank you.
You got another reader from talking.
Wonderful.
So I appreciate that.
Up to 50 maybe.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so very much for spending some time with us, Carl.
Thank you.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision, in association with Engineering.com. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.